Melody Moisey was born to Persian parents at the height of the Islamic Revolution and raised in the American heartland. When at 18, she began battling a severe physical illness, her community stepped up, filling her hospital room with roses, lilies, and hyacinths. But when she attempted suicide and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, there were no flowers. Despite several stays in psychiatric hospitals bombarded with tranquilizers, mood stabilizers, and antipsychotics, she was encouraged to keep her illness a secret by both her family and an increasingly callous and indifferent medical establishment. Refusing to be ashamed, Moisey became an outspoken advocate, determined to fight the stigma surrounding mental illness and reclaim her life along the way. She tells her new story in Haldol and Hyacinths. Melody Moisey, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It is. I really appreciate you being on the program. I really appreciate you sharing the story and writing about your experiences. At what point do you think you came to the determination that this was something that you wanted to talk about, and ultimately, because I assume it's a conscious decision of becoming a face for mental illness and trying to destigmatize it wherever you could?
Well, you know, I've been an activist pretty much all my life. When I was a kid, I organized all the neighborhood kids to get the ice cream man to come to our neighborhood, which he did. I'm very proud of that. But, you know, I had fought discrimination against the LGBT community, against Muslims after 9/11, especially in favor of the Iranian opposition. Basically, I'm a human rights activist. So when I was given the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, I was suddenly introduced, and, you know, hospitalized, I was suddenly introduced to this new community that was more stigmatized, more discriminated against than any other community I'd been a part of. And suddenly, you know, I was one of them. And I realized that this was a very, very silent and very large minority of people. 25% of Americans have a mental illness in a given year. 50% have a diagnosable mental illness in their lifetime. This is not a, you know, tiny minority of people. It's just a very, very silent group because of the stigma, because of the shame. So I decided to speak out about it because I thought as something that was no different than my work on women's rights or LGBT rights or working for other minorities.
Your diagnosis came in late 2008, and this was after an especially acute manic episode.
Yeah. It wasn't fun. Actually, at the beginning, it was really fun for me and no one else. But, yeah, in late 2008, I ended up having an acute manic episode and a psychotic break, essentially. I was having hallucinations, delusions, doing really impulsive things, out of character, naked in public kind of stuff, just the kinds of things that you associate with true, total crazy. That was me, and it was the first time in my life that I really had to deal with delusions and hallucinations to that extent as well.
And it wasn't until you started to be treated and medicated that you realized just how severe those actions were.
Yeah, once I actually got on the right medication, it was a miracle for me. I was able to function in a way that I hadn't been for a long time. I realized that there are services available for people with mental disabilities. I was in law school at the time. I was in my last year. I was having a really hard time the first time that I was hospitalized. Actually, that was for a suicide attempt. And I realized that there are disability services out there that not only are they available to us, they're legally required for public entities and universities to have these accommodations for us. And I'm not sure I could have made it through school without them. And I think it's important, you know, to share that information because I'm pretty positive a lot of people aren't aware that they have these rights.
What was your knowledge of bipolar? What was your knowledge of mental illness prior to your own diagnosis?
I knew nothing about bipolar. All I knew about it was that it was used as a pejorative. That's all I'd heard it used as,
right.
And I'm probably guilty of having used it myself. So I didn't know what it was. I when I got the diagnosis, I thought, oh, crap, this is real crazy, you know. I had had depression before. I had been misdiagnosed with unipolar depression, which I felt like was accepted a lot more than something like bipolar, which a lot of people associate as very debilitating. And over, I was told to lower my expectations for my life, despite the fact that I'd achieved a lot up to that point, and I hadn't even been treated and had been able to achieve that much. It just is really upsetting to me that people are told to lower their expectations, that they're going to be disabled for the rest of their lives. I have the most extreme form of bipolar disorder. I managed to finish law school, pass the bar exam, get a master's in public health. I managed to write a book, win an award for it, publish the second book, and I'm 34 years old. We are capable of extraordinary things, much more extraordinary than I've achieved in my life. It's just we're silent about it. So you don't know who has a mental illness and who doesn't.
So let's go to part of that process, which is you acknowledge in the book that your parents and your family were very understanding of the decision. They accepted the diagnosis. However, they did not want you to talk about it publicly, and they felt it was important that you keep it a secret, and I assume being done to protect you.
Yeah. Yeah, that was their goal. They didn't want me to destroy my reputation. I had built somewhat of a reputation. I had been writing about, my first book was about young Muslim Americans. There was also the risk that people would say, oh, she's crazy because she's Muslim, or she's Muslim because she's crazy, and then reinforce some stereotypes. There were different dangers that were apparent, but, you know, once I sold the book and was able to start making a living for the first time as a writer full-time, they were a lot more supportive. And because the thing is, in Iran, you can't be really a writer for a living. It's a hobby that you have on the side, but it's not something you can generally make a living at. So when they realized it was possible, they became a lot more supportive. For sure.
Do you think that background, that your cultural background, played a role at all in what you experienced?
Definitely. As an Iranian American, I write in the book about how it's like being the child of divorced parents. These are two countries that I identify with 100%. I consider myself 100% Iranian and 100% American. In these two countries, my entire life, I was born in 1979, the year of the Islamic Revolution. My entire life, these two countries have been at odds. Their governments have been the greatest of enemies. So that creates a real sort of bipolar identity. And it's not just, you know, I'm from another country and live in another country, that kind of thing. It's the fact that they are enemies to the extent that they have been.
But obviously that doesn't make you bipolar.
For sure, exactly. And that's a very good point to bring up. Bipolar is highly genetic. If you take twins and one twin has bipolar disorder, there's a 70% chance the other one will. In the general populations, it's 2 to 3% chance that someone will have bipolar disorder. So obviously there's a huge genetic component. A lot of scientists and psychiatrists believe that it's an illness where someone has a predisposition towards it. And given a certain amount of trauma, and for me that was a physical illness, I think, given a certain trauma, that people can start presenting with the illness. And if it's not treated early on, it gets worse. It's a chronic degenerative illness. But with treatment, people can really do wonderful things with their lives.
And this is something that you have to be on top of at all times, as far as monitoring and caring for the illness.
Definitely. Yeah, That's the one thing. When I was first diagnosed, I asked, you know, what should I do? What is my part? Obviously, I started taking medication that really has saved my life. But what else do I do? And I was told, just do everything everyone else, all the normal people are supposed to do. But it's just more important that you do it, that you eat well, that you exercise, all of that kind of lifestyle stuff. And it's important to note that people with mental illness have much more higher rates of physical illness, or what we call comorbidities in the public health community. And these physical illnesses are, a lot of it is attributable to the kinds of medications that are prescribed without a physician paying attention to the side effects and realizing that they're treating a full human being and not just their mind. A lot of it is attributable to the fact that we have smoking rates that are over 3 times the national average. 75% of people with mental illness on average smoke, and the mental health community has done a horrible job at helping with that. I was at one hospital where they almost, I mean, literally, they encouraged smoking. There was no way that you could go out and get fresh air without smoking being around you. You would have to deal with secondhand smoke. And on top of that, if you wanted to go outside at any other time than the prescribed times that you were allowed, the only way you would be allowed to do it was if you were a smoker. So a lot of people in that hospital took up smoking. And they also use cigarettes as a way to control patients, to say, if you don't do X, Y, or Z, I'm going to take away your cigarettes. So it's really, really a horrible thing that we have to deal with smoking. And I think smoking cessation programs are just as important when I talk about treating a whole human being.
I think the whole idea that you wrap up in the title of the book is that you can be physically ill and people will break down the door to come visit you and bring flowers, and yet you can go through the most harrowing event in your life and have an illness and people don't know what to do.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the hardest part of it, is being shut behind closed doors. I write in the book about the hardest part about being in a mental health facility is not in a locked ward, is not being locked in. It's being locked out of the rest of the world. I met some amazing people in mental hospitals. I made some of the best friends I have in mental hospitals, really smart people. But that concept of being locked out of the rest of the world, it's really torture. And the fact that there isn't more peer support, peer counseling. You know, AA is a great model to follow for mental illness, but we don't have the same kinds of programs of people who are succeeding with mental illness helping people who have just been diagnosed. So getting people in recovery to help people who have just been diagnosed is incredibly helpful. Organizations like the National Alliance on Mental Illness, like the Depression Bipolar Support Alliance, are places where people can get a lot of support, a lot of help. Their meetings are free, which is important because mental health care is expensive, and mental health parity, as much as everyone thinks it exists, it doesn't. The regulations to implement them don't really exist, and insurance companies aren't really abiding by the law.
It's a fascinating book. It is called Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. It is published by Avery. Melody Moisey, I thank you very much for sharing your story with us this morning. I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you, Joe.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Coming up, we will get a physician's perspective on mental illness and talk to Christine Montrose about her new book, Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.